Today is Tuesday, August 10th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, panic in Afghan city of Mazar al-Sharif as Taliban closes in.
The Taliban claimed they were attacking Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital of Balkh province, from four sides Monday morning.
Plus, UN calls for cuts to greenhouse gases to curb climate change.
This is just one of hundreds of intense fires burning across Greece, Turkey and Italy.
Also, Turkey police probe killing of seven members of a Kurdish family. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Panic gripped the northern Afghan city of Mazar al-Sharif Monday after news of a Taliban advance. VOA's Aisha Tanzin reports from Kabul that Taliban have overrun several provincial capitals in northern and northeastern Afghanistan since Saturday.
People fleeing from a burning city. The Taliban claimed they were attacking Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital of Balkh province, from four sides Monday morning. The claim was false. The only fighting reported was some 20 kilometers from the city. But the rumor traveled fast.
We Taliban are coming into Mazar city. It is impacting our business. People are escaping. 50% of the shops are closed. Although Taliban are still on the outskirts, people are scared.
The usually busy marketplaces shut down. Busy streets in central Mazar were deserted. People lined up in banks and at ATM machines to withdraw money. It did not help that another capital, Aibak of Samangan province, was overrun by Taliban on Monday. It was the sixth provincial capital to collapse since Friday. Five of the six are in the north or northeast of the country. The militants now control most of the north. The fear in Mazar was palpable.
I have a shop, but nothing is selling. Taliban are coming. The city is collapsing. Nobody is buying anything. People are worried that the Taliban could come any time. Anyone with money has escaped. The poor are left behind.
Witnesses said that during the panic in Mazar, they saw few security forces. Anyone who could afford it tried to escape. Travel agents reported double the business they have on a normal day. Even airlines doubled their flights.
Usually we have 2 to 3 flights daily from Mazar to Kabul, but it has increased to 5 to 6. In the past, the ticket was $85 one way, but now it has increased to $113. Since the situation deteriorated today, 60 to 70 people arrived in my agency to buy tickets to fly to a secure area.
In the afternoon, the Afghan military released a video on social media saying it had repulsed the Taliban attack on Dedadi district on the outskirts of Mazar. The northern capital is safe for now. But the fear and panic in the north remains. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
The Pentagon said on Monday that the security situation in Afghanistan was, quote, not going in the right direction, unquote, as Taliban militants captured a sixth provincial Afghan capital. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said the United States was deeply concerned about the trend, but that Afghan security forces had the capability to fight the insurgent group.
The secretary shares the concern of the international community about the security situation in Afghanistan, which is clearly not going in the right direction. And the secretary continues to believe that the Afghan forces have the capability, they have the capacity to make a big difference on the battlefield. He has maintained that we will continue to support them with the authorities we have where and when feasible, understanding that it's not always going to be feasible. But where and when feasible, we'll continue to support them with airstrikes, for instance. They have an air force the Taliban doesn't. They have modern weaponry and organizational skills the Taliban doesn't. They have superior numbers to the Taliban. And so, again, they have the advantage, and it's really now their time to use those advantages. The reason why not is because it's their country to defend now. This is their struggle. The commander-in-chief has given us a new mission, and that mission is to draw down by the end of this month, and that's where we're moving to. What it looks like beyond that, I'm simply not going to speculate. But this is their country. These are their military forces. These are their provincial capitals, their people to defend. It's really going to come down to the leadership that they're willing to exude here at this particular moment.
That's Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. The U.S. is deploying an array of aircraft to support Afghanistan government forces as the Taliban continued to ramp up their ground offensive, reportedly overrunning another provincial capital. A local lawmaker told media that the Taliban were fighting government forces in Aibak, the capital of the northern province of Samarkand. For more details, International Edition Steve Miller spoke with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon.
Well, we know that the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes for weeks now, even while the withdrawal has gone along and is almost complete, as it has been for a while now. The U.S. has had some of its platforms, and we're being told now that a lot of it is coming down to its AC-130 gunships and its MQ-9 Reaper drones flying over Afghanistan from afar, from places elsewhere in the Middle East, to come in doing patrols and basically helping out in areas where the U.S. is able to communicate with Afghan troops on the ground. And the focus has been, for the most part, in areas like Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah, where the Taliban have been pressing offense, and the Afghan government has sent some of its special forces to hold those key areas. Of course, at the same time, the Taliban have been pushing their offensive in other areas, and according to the Pentagon, in about the last 72 hours, have taken a total of about 5 provincial capitals. So U.S. air power is coming down. They also have B-52s that are coming from Al Udeid Air Base in the Middle East, and they also have F-18s, Stryker bombers that are able to launch from the carrier strike group that the U.S. has positioned in the Persian Gulf. But again, these are long-range flights, and so there's an impact, but in some ways a limited impact in terms of helping the Afghan forces on the ground that are facing just what appears to be a tsunami of Taliban forces trying to overrun key areas.
Has the Pentagon commented directly on the status of the fighting in Afghanistan? Are they going to do anything more, perhaps with more of the so-called over-the-horizon attacks?
Well, everything right now is over the horizon. There is no other option. The U.S. presence in Afghanistan in terms of its military presence really limited to Kabul and the embassy area, and then also to the international airport outside of Kabul. And that's it. There are no more airstrikes that can come from within Afghanistan. So everything is coming from afar right now in terms of what the U.S. can do to help out. In terms of how that fight's been going, the Pentagon said it is not going in the right direction, according to the press secretary, who was briefing reporters. And the press secretary, John Kirby, said that the U.S. will continue to support Afghan forces, but the focus continues to be on completing the drawdown, the U.S. drawdown, by the end of the month. He refused to speculate what U.S. support for Afghan forces might look like after that August 31st deadline, at which time the U.S. military withdrawal will be complete. The Pentagon, in response to a VOA question today, said that if Afghan troops don't put up much of a fight, there's really not much the U.S. can do to help them because, again, time element. And the other thing is to note, in terms of perspective, that after August 31st, there will be over-the-horizon airstrikes if needed, but it's going to be counterterrorism. Countering the Taliban is not considered counterterrorism. Just for perspective, U.S. airstrikes may continue, but in terms of the authorities that are in place, there are no authorities that we're aware of right now, or nothing that's been changed that would allow the U.S. after August 31st to continue airstrikes in support of Afghan government forces.
That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. A U.S. peace envoy is back in the Middle East to warn the Taliban not to pursue a military victory on the ground in Afghanistan. He is expected to deliver a blunt message that the Taliban government installed by force will not be recognized by the international community. The U.S. State Department says Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. envoy, was in Doha, Qatar, where the Taliban maintain a political office. Khalilzad's mission is to, quote, help formulate a joint international response to the rapidly deteriorating situation in Afghanistan, unquote. The development comes amid the Taliban offensive as American and NATO forces finalize their pullout from the war-torn country. Humans are unequivocally to blame for global climate change, and massive cuts to greenhouse gas emissions are urgently required if the world is to avoid catastrophic warming. That's the conclusion of a report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published Monday. Its findings are approved by 195 world governments. Heron Ridgewell reports from London.
On the Greek island of Evia, residents flee their homes beneath a sky of burning red as fires consume pristine forests turned to tinder by searing summer heat. This is just one of hundreds of intense fires burning across Greece, Turkey, and Italy, as summer temperatures have topped 45 degrees Celsius. The message from scientists: climate change is here. Professor Levent Kurnaz is a climate scientist at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul.
The Mediterranean will be having these forest fires all the time. Therefore, I mean, this is just the beginning. It's going to get much worse.
Intense heat and drought have triggered fires from the Mediterranean to Siberia to California. The report, compiled by 200 scientists from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, says temperatures have already risen by 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The United Nations Secretary General described the findings as code red for humanity. Co Barrett from the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is a vice chair of the IPCC.
This report tells us that each of the past 4 decades has been the warmest on record since pre-industrial time. Further, it is indisputable that human activities are causing climate change. Human influence is making extreme climate events, including heat waves, heavy rainfall, and droughts, more frequent and severe.
The report warns that global average temperatures will hit 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2030 on current trajectories, the limit agreed at the Paris Climate Summit in 2015 and seen as a tipping point by many scientists. That's 10 years earlier than previous forecasts. The report adds that sea level rises of up to 2 meters by the end of the century can't be ruled out, threatening millions of people living in coastal areas. And the Arctic is likely to see at least one ice-free summer by 2050. But scientists emphasize there is a way out. The worst scenarios can be prevented and global warming reversed, with drastic cuts to global emissions. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is the Voice of America. The office of Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on Tuesday urged, quote, all capable Ethiopians, unquote, to join the army, special forces and militias to support the fight against Tigrayan forces. The statement came roughly 6 weeks after the government declared a unilateral ceasefire in the northern region of Tigray. Reuters said it was not immediately possible to contact the spokesperson for Tigrayan forces or Abiy's representative for comment. Saudi Arabia has announced the arrest of 207 employees across multiple agencies, including the Interior and Defense Ministries. It's the latest sweep in the kingdom by an anti-corruption body empowered by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Those detained were not named, and it was not clear when the arrests were made. The kingdom's National Anti-Corruption Commission announced the arrests late on Monday. The Crown Prince's purge, which began in the late 2017, has helped him consolidate power and netted the kingdom $106 billion in assets. Saudi nationals have long complained of rampant corruption and misuse of public funds.
This is Science in a Minute.
The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has released Climate Change 2021, the physical science basis, the first of its 6th assessment report. The report finds that changes in the world's climate are extensive, swift, and intensifying. UN Chief Antonio Guterres calls the report, quote, nothing less than a code red for humanity, end quote. According to the report, researchers are finding climate changes in every region on Earth and the entire global climate system, and that many of these changes in climate are unprecedented over thousands and even hundreds of thousands of years. The IPCC report does suggest that robust and continuous reductions in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions would limit climate change. Doing so would quickly improve air quality, but it could take 20 to 30 years for global temperatures to stabilize. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Police in Turkey are investigating circumstances leading to the recent killing of 7 members of a Kurdish family. Rights groups and experts say the Turkish government should act swiftly prevent ethnic tensions. VOA's Siwan Kajo reports from Washington.
On July 30th, 7 members of an ethnic Kurdish family were killed in Turkey's central province of Konya. Yashar Dedeoglu, his wife Ipek, and five of their children were shot dead in a hail of 20 bullets. According to Turkish media, the attacker first spoke with the father before opening fire on the whole family. 6 days later, Turkish security forces detained Mehmet Altun, the main suspect in the shootings, but they said they were still investigating the circumstances of the killings. Local authorities' initial evidence pointed to an ongoing feud between the family and a Turkish family who lived nearby. But rights groups and relatives of the slain family said the attack was racially motivated.
They keep saying we are all brothers. If we are really brothers, how could seven members of a family get killed this way? They even burned down their house. Is this what brotherhood looks like?
The recent killings were brutal, but the killer or killers are not the only ones responsible for this crime. Those who are attacking the Kurds day and night in the media are also responsible.
Turkish officials have rejected claims that the attack was racially motivated. Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu said calling it a racist crime is a provocation. Turks and Kurds have a long history of ethnic tension in Turkey. Several attacks similar to that in Konya have been reported this year in the country. Kurds make up nearly 20% of Turkey's population of 83 million. But rights groups say they still lack many basic rights.
In the beginning of this incident, Turkey's Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu said right away the attack was not connected to racism, before anything was clear yet. This statement is problematic because the investigation is still ongoing. But whoever we talk to, they say if this family had not been Kurdish, they would not have been killed.
Rights advocates blame the government for turning a blind eye to such attacks and fueling racist sentiment.
The scapegoating of Kurds and other minorities has historically been an ongoing problem. And unless there is a concerted effort, both on the part of the government as well as the civil society, Turkey will continue to experience such targeting of Kurds and other ethnic and religious minorities within the country.
According to Turkey's Human Rights Association, in 2020, seven people were killed and 32 injured in some 14 racist attacks. Sirwan Kejo, VOA News, Washington.
There is growing discontent among Lebanese with political and military powerhouse Hezbollah calling the shots in the country. Analysts say 2006 style confrontation with Israel, which bolstered its militia image then, is not an option for Iran-backed Hezbollah now, as it's seen as part of the problem, not the solution. Even Lebanon's influential Maronite Catholic patriarch is calling the beleaguered country's army to, quote, confront the Hezbollah for the sake of Lebanon, unquote. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
Lebanese analyst Daniel Holiat Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut says that as Hezbollah has been accumulating and projecting power, it has simultaneously increased discontent among its opponents and positioned itself as a threat to others, seen most recently in a revenge killing involving a Sunni Muslim Arab tribe. Writing in the Saudi Arab News Daily, she says the incident showed that Hezbollah is not as invincible as it once seemed, and that it can be intimidated. This encouraged protesters to chant anti-Hezbollah slogans at the commemoration last week of the deadly 2020 Beirut bombing, Khatib says, with fingers pointing at the group for illegally bringing tons of ammonium nitrate into Beirut port. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has denied that the group has ever controlled Lebanese government or that it has a majority that would allow it to act on its own, according to the Arab Weekly online publication. Nasrallah has also repeatedly denied accusations that Hezbollah has maintained an arms warehouse at Beirut port or could be responsible for the tragic port blast. We have nothing in the port, not an arms depot, nor a missile depot, nor missiles, nor rifles, nor bombs, nor bullets, nor ammonium nitrate, he said in a televised speech shortly after the blast. Angry protests over corruption by the country's entrenched political elites now feature more public condemnation of Hezbollah, accusing the militia and political party with lawmakers in parliament of selling out their country to Iran. Mona Yacoubian of the United States Institute of Peace told London's Chatham House Research Group that Hezbollah has evolved from championing the resistance to Israeli occupation to becoming the Praetorian Guard of Lebanon's corrupt cronyist system.
Hezbollah, over years, has increasingly exploited state institutions, parliament, ministries, civil service, and used its influence to garner power, to spread patronage, to gain revenues. It has enmeshed itself into this very corrupt system. In the October 2019 protests and beyond, we see that Hezbollah is no longer viewed as above corruption. It has been tarnished by this behavior, even within its own base, that there's growing disaffection, and even its own reaction to the protests, seeking to quell them. What does this say about the trajectory of both the group and the country?
Lebanon's influential Maronite Catholic Patriarch Bashar Boutros al-Rai urged the army during his Sunday Mass to confront Hezbollah for the sake of Lebanon. We call upon the Lebanese army, which is responsible with the international forces for the security of the South, to take control of the entire lands of the South, to prevent the launching of missiles from Lebanese territory, not for the sake of Israel's safety, but rather for the safety of Lebanon, he said, quoted by Lebanon's national news agency. Al-Rai said that he could not accept that a party decides peace and war outside the national decision entrusted to two-thirds of the members of the government. He referred to 19 rockets fired from southern Lebanon into northern Israel on August 6. Some were intercepted and others fell in open spaces. There were no casualties. Analyst Dania Kholilat Khatib says Hezbollah should make the conscious decision to downsize, to dismantle its resistance brigades, and ask for other armed groups to also disarm in order to secure its own survival and spare Lebanon from a destructive confrontation. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
A leading epidemiologist and advisor to the World Health Organization is calling for a nighttime curfew and daily testing for workers to bring Sydney's COVID-19 outbreak under control. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
With a lockdown not producing the desired results in Australia's largest city, it's time to implement even stricter restrictions. That's the opinion of Professor Mary Louise McClaws, an epidemiologist from the University of New South Wales. She's also a member of a World Health Organization expert panel on COVID-19. The state government in New South Wales, of which Sydney is the capital city, has said that higher rates of vaccination, up to 80% of the population, are the key to the gradual easing of restrictions. But McClaws says the benefits of mass inoculations will take time to reduce the spread of the Delta variant. State authorities in New South Wales concede they may be forced to abandon the policy of trying to eliminate the virus because the spread of infections in Sydney is proving hard to stop, despite Australia's strictest lockdown. Instead of trying to crush the virus, officials say Australia might have to live with it and hope the population would be protected by mass vaccinations. Indeed, New South Wales set a new daily record Tuesday with 356 recently diagnosed COVID-19 infections. State Premier Gladys Berejiklian is pleading with residents, especially those in Sydney's virus hotspots, to get vaccinated. Australia's inoculation rates are much lower than other countries. About 22% of eligible Australians older than 16 have been fully inoculated. There have been problems with supply, but crucially, there have been widespread concerns in the country about possible side effects of the AstraZeneca vaccine. A third vaccine, Moderna, has been approved by the Therapeutic Goods Administration, Australia's official medical regulator. 1 million doses are expected to arrive in September of the 10 million doses ordered. The AstraZeneca and Pfizer treatments were approved earlier this year. Australia has recorded 36,330 coronavirus cases and 936 deaths since the start of the pandemic, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Research Centre. The country's virus strategy includes the closure of its international borders to most foreign travellers, strict lockdowns, and mass testing. A lockdown that began last Thursday in Melbourne, Australia's second biggest city, continues. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a good evening.